The Economist newspaper recently summed up the challenge of being a senior leader today as the escalating battle to reconcile seemingly conflicting behaviours. As they put it, be more talented than others in the firm, but don't tell them what to do. Crush the competition while exuding empathy. Listen charismatically. Be likably aggressive. CEOs have always been abnormal. The trick now is don't show it. In this show, we talk with Rob Murray, a leadership thinker who strives for a deep level of authenticity, whilst at the same time being supremely pragmatic in the realities of organizational life.
Hey folks, welcome to The Evolving Leader. I'm Scott Allender.
And I'm John Gomes.
How are you feeling today, Mr. Gomes?
I'm feeling pretty energized and sparky today, actually. How are you feeling?
I don't know if I've ever felt sparky, but I do feel energized. I'm super excited to be joined by our guest today. Today we're joined by the one and only Rob Murray. Rob is the co-founder and CEO of Transformed Leader, a consultancy organization that draws from the collective value of research, professional experience, and expert associates to design and deliver experiential, integrative content that fuels wholehearted leadership, which is going to be a big theme of what we're talking about today. Rob is the co-author of The Human Operating System, Recovering the Heart and Soul of Your Leadership, and is currently completing his doctorate of transformational leadership. I know Rob a little bit personally, and I have seen firsthand his passion for helping leaders and teams engage deep change strategies both personally and professionally. Rob, welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Yes, John and Scott, it is so good to be with you today. Thank you for having me.
Rob, welcome to the show. How are you feeling today?
Sad, lonely. I'm going to my feelings check in here. Maybe excited. Excited to be here, a little sad. Definitely some loneliness. And I probably have a few more, but you caught me off guard. I've never done a feelings check in so quickly at the start of a podcast.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Maybe we can come back to some of those things when you have a chance to kind of process it. But let's start with something that's a little bit more kind of tangible and safe. What your story? We'd love to learn more about the work of your organization and what motivated you to start your business in the first place.
Great question. In my line of work, I always say, and several others say, I probably picked it up from someone, is pain is a great motivator. I study the field of change, and very rarely do we wake up in the morning and say, ooh, you know what I feel like doing today is changing. And so normally it's when we feel the friction of challenge or life gets us willingly or unwillingly, but life changes. And that's what happened to me. My motivation for the work that I do and the things that I chase on a daily basis these days has been inspired from a very, very personal motivation. I got several stories, and feel free to chime in. I get a little excited. This is my life. And these are the things that have shifted and shaped me. But I'll think of two stories that have motivated me. And I look back and I go, gosh, I want to say about 5 years ago, my wife sat me down on the bed and she told me how lonely it was to be married to me. And I don't know if you've had any moment like that, but, you know, I'm nearing the end of my 30s, and to have your wife sit you down and say, I'm lonely with you. It's lonely to be married to you. Hmm. I want more connection with you. And the thing she offered was, you're a great dad. You're actually a great husband. You're a great provider. You're a good this. You show up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm lonely with you. So that was probably one of the initiating realities of what started to motivate me, because, John, the reality was I was lonely with myself, and I just hadn't quite figured that out. And so she was giving words out loud, which is pretty scary. But she was offering me the intimacy of her insides, the depth of what's going on inside of her, and it really confronted me. I didn't take it very well, by the way. In retrospect, I can rewrite the history, but I didn't like what she was saying. And it took me about 2 or 3 days to realize she was right. Like she was lonely with me, but then secondly, oh gosh, I'm lonely with myself. And I'd realized that I had lost parts and pieces of who I was, climbing the corporate ladder, chasing education. And I looked down and I was like, man, I'm a machine. And so the parts of my humanity that were in operation were pushed way down into my marriage, my relationships, my friendships. And I was in a kind of get it done mode, like that think smarter, work harder kind of mentality. And it came to a head when she sat there and said, I want more with you. Very, very painful experience, and yet catalyzed what I would say the very work that I do to this day. I don't know if you've had an experience like that. A lot of people have.
Yeah. No, I think that resonates. I mean, as you were talking about that, I mean, the way that you've kind of summed that up, this losing connection with oneself because you're so caught up in the doing and the striving and the, reacting, being defined by other people's expectations of you. And then actually never having a chance to sit back and go, so what do I want? What do people around me really want? Because you create that story that I'm working for you. I'm providing for you and all that sort of stuff. That really resonates. But, what were you losing? I mean, you say you're lonely with yourself. What do you mean by that?
Well, loneliness in of itself as an emotion, I don't think is actually a bad thing. I think it's actually the recognition of I'm not receiving the level of connection that I desire with this person or with oneself. And so lonely in the sense that in your 20s and 30s, I don't know about yours, but mine were very much like, how do I prove to the world that I have what it takes to show up, crush, kill, destroy, drag home, repeat, day in and day out, like watch me go. I'm going to show you. And for me, I had some childhood wounds that were driving me. But for most people, even the biological development of human psychology will tell you that those 20s and 30s are years of establishing a sense of activity to prove that you belong on this planet. And so sometimes in the midst of that, you can go, well, I do all these things, but who the hell am I? I don't even know who I am anymore. And my wife was saying, I want you. And the problem was, no matter how smart and hardworking I was, I didn't know who I was. So she was asking for something I didn't have for myself. That's where the loneliness kicks in. I want more connection with self, and yet I don't know how to get there. Oh gosh, this is scary.
So when you break down this kind of loss of identity, how much of it was to do with the work? How much was it to do with, just the strain of bringing up, being in a relationship and modern life? And I'm guessing, judging your accent, that you're not living, in your home country. Is there something about being, like an outsider in another country? Is that all part of it as well? What if you break it down into its parts, what do you think was going on?
Man, trying to be South African in this country, they make fun of my words. Scott, just the things he says to me are hurtful.
Yeah, I know what that's like being a Brit. He's always on my case.
Sorry.
apparently water, they don't know what water is. It's water or something like that. But anyway, I don't even know if it's, man, it's such a conflicting reality because I do a lot of study around the midlife transition. And I don't even know if you, maybe you lose your identity. That's a fair word, but you almost give it up. It's like you offer it. I almost want to say you offer your identity or you open yourself up to forming your identity and in the process lose the essence. We talk about the essence or the substance of who you are. I'll do anything to belong. I'll do anything to not have you reject me. I'll do anything for you to keep me. Well, in your 20s, what does that mean? It means perform. It means deliver. It means climb through the ranks. And so as I break it through, I think I was climbing.
And fit in.
100%. And the more work I get into psychologists and when you start to look at human need, it's the idea that can we fit in? Can we belong here? Do I have a tribe? And then does my life count? Like purpose, right? Do I have purpose? So I'll give up anything to belong. The things people do to belong, I mean, abuse. I mean, you'll be physically abused just to remain in a tribe. It's why gangs are so successful. They get you to do things, but you'll do them because you don't want to be rejected. I was in a gang of the corporate ladder. It's a whole community where we all look at each other and say, if we keep climbing this ladder, proving that we have what it takes, we're going to be okay, right? And then we can all justify the fact that we can climb this ladder at the expense of everything else in our lives. You good with that? You good with that? Yeah, work harder, push, push, push. So maybe I, without knowing, jumped into that and then woke up one day where the people around me that really wanted me were saying, hey, I see you. Like, I want you. I need you. And I really was confronted with the reality that I better find out what they're talking about. The good news is your insides of your being cry out for the very same thing. So I don't want to be a machine, and yet I act like one. There's consequences for being one. But I believe the my biology and my design as a human being, it cries out for depth and intimacy and connection. It's just your 20s and 30s aren't that conducive when you're trying to prove to the world that you've got what it takes to have a place or a space on this planet.
So after that very painful conversation with your wife and having some time to reflect on it and see the truth in it, what was your first move?
Oh gosh. I don't know how, and I don't know why, because I've spent a lot of my life living alone. I'm going to figure this out myself, but I realized I didn't know what she was talking about. I realized she was right. And I realized there was something I needed, but didn't know how to get to. And so I did the very thing that I think a lot of leaders need, a lot of marriages need, a lot of people need in general, is to find someone who can guide you through the places you need to go. Maybe someone who's been there before. So I'll call that a guide. You can call it a psychologist, a counselor, a friend. And I'm not just talking about a rah-rah, work harder. Someone who has the ability to see the landscape of the thing you're facing. So I needed a guide. So I actually reached for a guide. And I said, I need someone to take me to these places and submit myself to some journey. I didn't know this at the time, but this is what we do in our work. We guide people on journeys that they have never taken or don't know how to take by themselves, or they've tried to take it by themselves. Well, we just kind of come alongside and walk with them. And I reached out for someone to do that. And I didn't like what I found out. I was hoping for tips and tricks. Hey, Rob, all right, here's three things to love your wife better. Here's how you can forge connection, blah, blah, blah. Like, I was really hoping for that. Maybe prescribe me a book. I'll do a book review even. But the guide, and his name was Jeff. He said to me, Rob, you're going to, and I love this because he catalyzed a lot of what I'm talking about. He said, the only way you will give your wife and your children the connection that they want is to go get it for yourself. Now I live in a little bit of an online media world where I'm like, oh, that's vanity. And, it's all this self-introspection, and you can actually get lost there. And everyone's always worrying about themselves and that you spend too much time there. And I was like, that's ridiculous. But what I started to realize what he meant. He said, Rob, if you don't have a sense of self, how can you offer someone something you don't have? And I was like, well, that's a fair question. And then I said, well, I need to go again, this sounds so ridiculous, but how do I go find myself? And he goes, well, let's go into your story. And the power of story gets you out of the logical brain, right? It puts you into the, I would call the soul part of your brain. It's like more the metaphor, the story, the analogies that have shaped us. And so I went on a story to rediscover who I was, how I had been changed and shaped through my life, and then the decisions and judgments I made, the behaviors that followed. And through that process, I think I gained a little bit of a more clear perspective of who I am, and then thought, wow, this is terrifying, but exciting. And as I started to do that work, what I realized was, indirectly, my wife was starting to connect, get more connection from me as a byproduct of that work. Now, I'm a fan of marriage work, trust me. I do avoid it at times because it is kind of painful to show up to anything. But as I was working with myself, my wife began to do some work on herself. And what do you notice? Like, the two of us start to lean towards each other. Mm-hmm. And we're probably now at the place where we're looking at each other saying, how do we take these two parts to who we are? And then, you know, we've said yes to one another. So how do we cultivate a stronger union? But a union is not like an amalgamation of two human beings. It's there's Rob and there's Natalie and then there's us. There's three parts to our equation, Rob, Natalie, and us. So I had to do some Rob work. She's been doing some Natalie work, and we're committed to the Rob and Natalie show. So we're in this, and it's been a tremendous gift for me. But again, catalyzed very much by my wife identifying loneliness, saying it out loud, having the words to express it, and then me painfully trying to hear. And those are some of the recipes of emotional intelligence that none of us want. We don't know what we're feeling. We don't know how to say it out loud, and no one's even listening if we do. So that was the recipe that came together, and then just a hell of a lot of hard work, which we still continue to do today to remain connected. So that was one of the stories.
Yeah. So
I'm exhausted.
Thank you.
Take a break.
We'll be right back after these messages.
These important messages. I'm just going back in my mind because, you know, this is fascinating in terms of being able to talk about the relationship with our partners and the effect that has on our leadership, because it's an object lesson in so many things that we never have to really confront at work.
Yes.
Unless we're forced to by some crisis. So, you know, I go back a long time to the start of my career, and I remember a client I worked with in the early 80s who's saying to me, you know, like, one of the things I always do when I hire people is I invite the partner, husband or wife or girlfriend, boyfriend to, you know, to dinner. And because I want to understand whether their relationship is, you know, what their relationship looks like. And if they've got a great relationship, which is really, you know, equal and loving and, you know, and so on, I know something about that person that I can't find anywhere else through a job interview. I know something about them. And I only really want people who are in those kind of relationships in my business, because then they look after my people and my customers. And then about 3 or 4 years later, I was working with one of the big management consultancies, and the partner said to me, I really want to meet the partners of the people I'm hiring, because I want to know that they're not actually in a great relationship. I'm paraphrasing here, because I want them to sacrifice everything.
I love that you said that, because I was about to offer that alternative. That's beautiful. I mean, it's not beautiful, the reality, but you're right.
No, but it was the truth.
It was the truth.
One felt kind of old-fashioned, probably because I'd heard it a long time ago, but it was so profoundly healthy and true. Yeah. And then this other kind of more... like, and the same partner said to me, like, we hire people who are very bright and insecure, because that's the perfect mix. You know, the lambs and the lions, you know, the lions are the people who run the business, and the lambs are the ones that, you know, run around in front of us doing all the work.
Well, you're describing, so your motivation was health, culture, the care of the human. And maybe the second example was, well, we really value outcomes, productivity, no matter what. And so I work with companies that are struggling. We want a great culture. And I work with a lot of professional sports teams. Well, they want a great culture, but not at the expense of winning. So if they can take an insecure 20-year-old who has massive father wounds or mother wounds, and they can be deeply channeled towards becoming a machine, they're like grateful for the opportunity. Now, they won't say that, and they'll be offended, someone hearing this, but I'm telling you, there are companies that I work with. They have 10, 15, 50,000 employees. And I know in some of those companies, they struggle to see the people who work for them as humans. They say it in concept, but what they really want is people that are driven to prove that they have what it takes by the way they perform. So doing, and you're describing, well, we want to meet your spouse or your partner because we want to get a sense of your being. So there's the being and the doing. And my work is helping. I don't have a prejudice towards either. I want to integrate both the head and the heart, the being and the doing. And if I come into a sports team and they fire me because you know, I'm not very good. I'm like, well, of course, because I don't know how to do this. And so, no, you're right. You're spot on. But Jean, you talked about this idea of inviting your spouse into your life. And I didn't invite Natalie. I'm grateful she showed up, but it wasn't an invitation. And if anything, I'd actually try to avoid it. We avoid conversation. And yet the number one leadership trait that I do through all my research, it comes out with top CEOs over and over and over again, is they want to be more self-aware. Okay, would you say you'd like to be a more self-aware leader? Everyone in the room nods yes. So then I say, well, I got a great exercise for you. Now, because I've painfully went through this unwillingly, I can now prescribe it. And I sit there and I go, would you like to be self-aware? Yes. All right, I'd like you to go home tonight. I'd like you to sit on the couch, clear the table, make sure everyone's asleep when they need to be, the kids, get everything done. I want you to sit on the couch and look at your spouse and say, I would like you to tell me what it feels like to be married to me. And then you're going to have to ask them three times because they're going to lie a few times. Okay? They're going to lie. Because really, you're like, well, do you really want to know? Well, I can't really tell them the truth. So the first few answers are like, well, you're great. You know, you're awesome. It's very vague and obscure, ethereal. Ask again. No, like really, what is it like to be married to me? And then they'll go again. And then it's normally about the third or fourth time where you ask the same question in a different way. Like, I really want to know all of what it's like to be married to me. You'll probably hear this. Well, if you really want to know, and that's when you put your seatbelt on. Because you are now about to get a little bit of the truth of how that person experiences you. And I sit there and I go, here's the rule. You're not allowed to respond or counteract anything they say. All you can do is say, thanks for sharing. Tell me more. Those are the only words you can use. So, man, it's really lonely to be married to you. Oh, gosh, thanks for sharing. Tell me more. Like, how lonely is it? And over the hour, you are sitting there gaining the very thing you asked for, self-awareness. Hmm. And yet leaders are like, I mean, normally the room erupts with like, that's the craziest idea I've ever heard. And I'm like, well, that's how you gain it. Hmm. Not sticking your head in the sand, pretending everything's awesome.
I think that's a great exercise. And I can feel the audience squirming as you talk about it. I just build on it and say, maybe do it on a walk instead of late at night, because you're definitely not going to sleep.
well, and a walk is great too, because you're the right-left brain. Just by the way, you do enough brain stuff.
Yeah.
But a walk is a great way for a hard conversation. But either way, yeah, don't do it late at night. I'm in bed by like 6-7 o'clock. So I'll tell you another compounding story. About 2.5 years ago, I'd started this work. Now, part of my wife's experience catalyzed the fact that I needed deep change and transformation in my life. I had divorced parts of my story, and I'm waking up, you know, I'm in my 40s now, in my early 40s. So I'm probably right on time to become this, you know, what do I want to do when I grow up? And I'm not just killing and dragging everything home. But my wife initiated that. And I know a lot of men that, and I say men because I work with a lot of executive men, and a lot of those men that I work with are not, they're still in their 50s and 60s doing the same thing they were doing in their 20s and 30s. And so I was grateful for that. And as I started to lean into this work, part of it is I needed to first do my work, because I can't offer you anything on this phone call. I promise you, there's nothing I'm saying on this. We're not on phones, but there's nothing we're saying on this podcast today that I haven't learned through the suffering of my own life, through the work of my own life. And I'm going along all great and dandy. I work with a gentleman called Jack Nicholson, not the actor. And Jack and I are running a leadership cohort at my house here in Franklin, Tennessee, just outside of Nashville. And Scott, I don't know how much you know about the story, but I'd run a group. They're a leadership group. They're all there. They come, they go. And guys, I don't know this until a few days later, but I end up having a series of strokes. You know, so now I'm 39 years old. And I had five strokes. I lost my memory. I was taken to hospital. My wife was in California on a getaway. She actually called me and I was scrambled, and she realized, oh my gosh, something is really terribly wrong. So people swept in, ambulances took me away. My children are coming home from school. I have no memory. I was stuck in a 2-3 minute groundhog loop day. I was just the same questions over and over, get to the end, start again. And I end up in the hospital, and they had worked out that I had injured my neck. I had this kind of young person's stroke, same thing that people get when they're older for different reasons, but I had injured my neck. And those blood vessels had tried to heal themselves, and the blood clots had got dislodged, gone to my brain, and caused absolute havoc. And so I come around. I want you guys to know, this is like a, you want to talk about, I mean, I would have preferred to go buy a Ferrari or something else, or Harley Davidson at my midlife split, but I had a stroke, and I call it the stroke of midlife. It's a thing I'm working on right now, where really a baptism from this early adulthood into middle adulthood. If you study life cycles, I'm right at that intersection of the midlife transition. And it's like the stroke just took me and threw me out of the game and said, you have no ability to work harder and think smarter. So who are you now, and who will you become? And man, I came out of the hospital, and I spent the first year, guys, I was going to bed 2 in the afternoon, awake for a few hours, asleep for more, lying around. My eyesight came back. I had lost it just a little bit. My memory started to come back a little bit. And I've been recovering for 2.5 years from having 5 strokes. And that humbled me. And it also brought me to the most crystal clear position of saying, who am I? And I'd started that work already. And then it was, what do I want from this life? Like, how do I want to express my life? And I would say that moment has still, even 2.5 years ago, is still shaping me to this day. So when I wake up and I look on at my schedule, and I'm with you guys today, I want to be with you today. I do very little things that I don't want to do anymore, that do not align with a deeper sense of meaning and purpose in my life. And that was not the case 2.5 years ago. Give me a great idea, put either some fun next to it, some dollar signs, or just a good time, and I'm in. Now it's like, well, it doesn't matter how much, it doesn't matter what it costs. Is this how I'd like to express my life in the world, with my family, with myself, with my leadership, with my work? So that's the stroke of midlife, I call it. I'm still in it. And it was radical, a radical, radical transformation. I'd never wish it on anyone. But isn't it the same that most of your listeners, they've gone through a divorce? Some of them have gone through a medical diagnosis. Some of them have gone through losing a loved one. Some of them have gone through something like what I described. Maybe it's something else. So I have taken my story, and I'm beginning to start to study some of the traits and the characteristics around these transitions we have when change is forced on us by your wife, by a stroke, and who knows what else. But I guarantee you, by the time I close my eyes on this earth, change will be forced on me repeatedly. Not to name the COVID-19 reality, that was forced change. So I study change, but it's because my story is about change. My life is about change.
Thank you for sharing both of those.
You're welcome.
Deeply profound and personal stories. How are you feeling physically now, before we move on? I'd like to know.
Well, so one of my feelings is cared for. So I feel cared for by you. You're caring for me. So I immediately identify, unless you were joking, because I use sarcasm to avoid intimacy all the time. That's one of my, I feel like you care for me. So I feel cared for. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah. Well, I do care for you. So let's bring these stories all the way forward to today and talk about how it informs the work that you're doing, how it informed the book that you wrote. I'm supremely interested in this delineation you make on the heart and the soul of leadership. So can you tell us a bit more about how this has informed your work and your writing and your research?
Yes. So I have a faith background. I don't need you to have one, because you can go to Carl Jung, you can go to psychologists, you can go to whatever field, sociology, psychology, theology. And there's a general consensus that as human beings, that we're not just your mind, you're not just your heart. So Jack and I, and Jack has really mentored and guided me through this work. But there's an idea that the human being is comprised of a heart, soul, mind, and strength. I have a body, I have a heart, I have a soul, and I have a mind. When you differentiate this, it allows, in my work, most of the times we're dealing with leaders, they're dealing with a situation where they're fused. It's like they don't know where they start and stop and where the situation shows up. They don't know what they're feeling, thinking, needing, wanting. Everything's just like a cluster. And when I start to look at leadership development through the lens of heart, soul, mind, strength, I ascribe to the word integration, which is not a great word. It's not super catchy on a business card. But the point is, integration is the ability to differentiate the parts of a whole and then integrate them back into the whole. Okay, it's very helpful. So that's how we do our work. Two people screaming at each other, I'm going to notice that there's emotions and defenses and judgments and all and shadows and stories that inform the shouting. So I'm going to try to pull them back, start to differentiate the parts and pieces, and then bring it back into a more constructive conversation that can lead to some kind of change. So Jack and I do a lot of work around heart, soul, mind, strength. We wrote this in a book, The Human Operating System, Recovering the Heart and Soul of Your Leadership. We don't think the heart and soul is better. We just think there's enough going on in the marketplace around mind and strength, like strategy and execution. People eat that for breakfast all day long. So our operating system is like a chessboard, which is not even that sexy. Like, when's the last time you thought about the operating system on your phone? You just care about the apps. Well, what does it do for me? Like, you know, maybe it's Tetris or chess, or I play online chess, like, because I'm like that. I'm like having a fun time playing people. And in the end, I didn't sit around and think, ooh, tell me about the OS, the Mac OS that's actually driving my phone. But our book is an OS. It's an operating system to install. And around the heart, soul, mind, strength is very important, because if I show up and you say, how am I feeling? Which of the four quadrants were you accessing? How are you feeling is probably linked to heart, soul, mind, or strength. What's your guess?
Heart.
Exactly. So you asked me a heart question. Okay. And so I try to answer you from the heart. I feel cared for. Now, I could have answered you from the head, which would be, I'm great, man. Thanks for asking. How are you? Now, that's like the head. I'm just trying to get it away from my heart. Mm-hmm. But I actually sat there for a minute. So in our work, we're starting to take leaders and say, how can we help them recover the heart and the soul attributes of who they are as humans so that they can reintegrate that into the way that they strategize and execute in the mind and the body? And I'm telling you, most of the companies we work with are mind and strength kind of related. Most of the nonprofits we work with are actually a lot of heart and soul. And they actually have very little strategy and execution. Not all of them, but a lot of them have a lot of passion, a lot of feelings, a lot of dreaming, but they actually lack the systems and the structures to actually execute upon those visions. So once again, we actually work down below the line with businesses, and sometimes above the line with nonprofits or with a leader. And I'm in Nashville. You know how many Nashville musicians are here? They're all passion.
A couple.
Yeah, there's just a few. They're all passion. They're writing about, you know, these beautiful metaphors and stories. And in the end, they have to bring those songs to the world. And so that is mind and strength attributes. So it's not like heart and soul is better. It's like all four are good, but be integrated.
So if I ask you how you're feeling, and that's a heart question, what's a soul question? What's the difference?
When I think of the soul, it's Simon Sinek, start with why. I like thinking of when Simon says start with why, it's a curiosity of purpose. It's a curiosity of vision. When you ask me, who am I? Well, Rob, as you went on this journey with your wife and with your company and with your strokes, what did you discover about yourself? Like, who are you? That to me is very soul driven. We're having a conversation today. My soul would say this when I get off this call. Why? Again, a curious why, not a shameful why. We often use why as a shaming word. But I go, I wonder why did I say yes to be on this podcast today? what was the deeper meaning and purpose behind my yes? Because if I don't have the soul aligned in my leadership, I just say yes to everything, either because it's strategic or it delivers some outcome. But if I'm delivering outcomes that's not attached to the soul, so you may make as much money in the world, you may have more money than you know what to do with, but if you have no purpose, you're good up here, but you lack substance. And the amount of millionaires that we work with that have no deeper sense of meaning in their life is astounding, because they've given their lives to mind and strength. So our work, Jack and I's work with them, is to sit in the soul. We like to get how they feel, because the feelings are very, I don't want to say a feeling. I may feel one way today and I may feel another way tomorrow. I want to become very intellectual in my feelings, emotionally intellectual through the connectivity of that feeling. But then I want to bring those feelings over to the soul and say, man, if I'm really feeling this in my company, let me come over to the soul and start to ask the bigger questions. And I always like to imagine when I'm doing soul work, it's like standing on a mountain, like Gandalf, if you do Lord of the Rings, like he's always up on a mountain surveying the land. And it's like Gandalf was the soul. He was the soul of whatever was happening through those storylines. And he could see it all and place it all. And he had vision for what was happening. I want that. So I go up onto a mountain. I will say the soul is very shy. I avoid the soul, by the way. I do a lot of emotional intelligence work, which makes me an avid fan of the heart. I can do a feelings group on the drop of a dime, but you stick me into the soul and have me be more contemplative, more considerate, and create more space and breath within the context of my leadership. I start calling someone to help me. Like, can you help me find my soul? I know how to do stuff. I know how to think. I know how to access my feelings, but my soul. So in my leadership work, I spend a lot of time investing in soul, and I normally have to outsource that. And it's I just acknowledge it, but notice that it's not what's wrong with me. What's right with me is I acknowledge that I am less versed in this area of my leadership, and I'm therefore making choices and actions and putting myself in environments that will cultivate more soul. Does that make sense? And then I've got to bring that back into the whole, or I'm just a guy who knows how to feel, or a guy who knows how to do, or a really smart guy who really doesn't know how to leave his books. And I really want to cultivate what we call, and you've called it too, holistic sense of leadership. Yeah. So heart, soul, mind, strength, to me, it's the most simple. We didn't invent nothing around that. We're just driving people back to the chessboard to say, just remember how you were made. Remember how you were made. And I can just pinpoint, you know, any assessment, any book, any message, any keynote talk, you just start to plug it. Oh, they're trying to make me smarter. Oh, they're trying to pump me up to go get more done. Oh, they're trying to get me to connect to my insides. Oh, they're trying to help me understand a deeper sense of meaning and perspective. You can start to scatter plot your team, your relationships, your attributes of leadership, the books you read, the conferences you go to. And if all you do is go to rah-rah conferences, just know that your ability to execute is probably highly developed, but maybe you should spend a little more time investing in some of those other parts of your leadership makeup.
Yeah, and I love the way you're describing this. It reminds me of the philosopher John Gray, who makes a distinction between knowledge which accumulates over time.
Yes.
And craft skills that have to be learned and applied by every generation again and again and again. You can't codify a why for somebody. You can't codify you know, your emotions. You have to learn about them, and then you have to apply what you learn. And I think every generation therefore has to have a refresh of the language, because the previous generations either might seem old-fashioned or hippie-ish, or, you know, they put some sort of language around it which is unappealing. And it's hard as well, as you've said.
Very hard. And I'm going to push back on something you said, because I have trigger words, because I can't unsee my quadrants. You said you've got to learn about the heart and you've got to learn about the soul. So what I hear, because I'm so deeply enmeshed in my matrix, when I think learn, I think mind. So I have I have to learn about my heart. And I would push back and say, no, you need to experience your heart.
Yeah. No, you I
know you meant that, but you guys can see how, like, I in my language, it's like Well, how do you experience your heart? Oh gosh, you have to do it. It's like the gym. I've got 3 gym memberships right now, and I haven't gone to gym once last week. Okay, I can't.
Well, I really agree with you, and hence I was making the distinction between the knowing of knowledge and learning and so on, which is, you know, which is mind. It's all about the mind part of it, and businesses, you know, really value that, because then you can codify it, you can teach other people how to do it, you can write it down in books and so on, but you can't do that. With these skills, and hence the craft bit of it is you can only do it when you experience it.
Spot on.
Yeah, we're saying we mean the same thing. Yeah, but I really do acknowledge the word is not necessarily the best one. What can we just dig into the emotional part of it for a little bit?
Moment? Yes,
because you know we are really fascinated with emotions, not as this kind of hardwired thing, but as a sense making mechanism.
Yes.
And we had Lisa Feldman Barrett on season 1, and her whole theories around constructed emotions kind of overturning the traditional view. And I think you're doing some research in this area as well.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the work you're doing with your PhD at the moment?
Yes. So I am exhausted. Apparently, you have to live life, run businesses, and then casually just get a doctorate on the side. So once again, sucker for punishment over here. But I love what I do. And I love what you just said. You just said, can we turn to the heart? Emotion. Can we? And the emotion is an expression of your heart. It's not the whole part of your heart. But I am doing a lot of research in this. So I am neck deep. There are books all around me. There are deadlines looming. I'll have phone calls today, interviews, people within my research right now. That I am logging, deepening, diving into, and my sole goal is to uncover some of the values and the outcomes and the benefits. Now there may be some negatives too, if I want to be a true researcher and not so biased as I may be. Is to see what is it like for leaders to start to access what they're feeling, and then to actually process those feelings in a way that are human, and what does that mean? What does human mean? How do you show up to your emotions in a way that can start to help you have more relationship with yourself so you have something to offer other people? So I do a lot of work around helping deepen a sense of, I use core feelings, and I like Lisa's work, and I don't use core feelings in the way that she refutes them. There is a core feelings theories that have been out there, and their facial expressions and all these different things. And I don't approach core feelings so much from that. I use core feelings in a very socialized way to form a common language. So I am able to put up a list of core feelings that we can all agree, for the most part, helps give voice to the parts of what's going on inside of us. And if you and I can just agree that these are the 12 feelings we're going to use, well then, we're going to be able to learn how to speak the same language. And if we can speak the same language, we're going to have a whole lot of an easier and better time learning how to connect to one another. So I'm neck deep in this. I'm a huge fan of this, of helping leaders connect to their heart. And if they can start with what they feel, they're going to be far more informed to create strategies and execute upon things that have been informed through their heart. But have you ever been at the other end of someone who's making a decision based on feelings they don't know they have? They could be afraid, but they don't know they're afraid. Or they could be sad, but they don't want to acknowledge their sadness. And now you're the recipient of their behavior, which can be highly toxic, confusing, convoluted. So I spend my life trying to help people identify what they're feeling and figure out how to say that out loud and then know that they've been heard. And there's something about it that says, wow, I'm starting to give voice to my insides, and it really starts to apply to the outside of that person's life.
And you know, moving past the kind of obvious answer to this, which might be fear, what are the kind of most prevalent emotions that people are running away from or avoiding or suppressing that are governing their behaviors?
You're right. Fear is a real one. I'm afraid. Fear is a great emotion. I look at emotions not as the initial emotions. I'm like, well, they inform us of something. They invite us into something. But fear and confidence. I've seen a link between the feeling of confidence and fear. Have you ever felt confident? Well, to access confidence, you have to also be able to manage fear, because confidence says, I'm going to go out into the world and deliver some form of action based on my confidence. The fear is that my action may cause something bad to happen, or I may fall flat, I may be rejected. So I noticed that people want to be confident, but you can't be confident without fear. So that's an interesting thing that I've been noticing lately through some of my groups. It's a connection I've made. Guilt and shame. Obviously, Brené Brown has done a fantastic job of diving into shame. And guilt and shame are very easily confused. Mm. We often feel guilty for things we shouldn't feel, like false guilt. We want to make ourselves the problem so we feel empowered. Like, if I'm the problem, if I just make myself guilty, whether I am or not, at least I'm empowered to do something. Because heaven forbid you're having those feelings and I'm not to blame. Now I just have to be with you in your emotion, which is a lot scarier. I'd rather have something productive to do. So I'm like, well, all right, well, it's probably my fault. I'm sure I can better myself. Now I have a job to do. So guilt and shame, they're like, you know, they just, it's to your point, it feels so obvious, but it is two feelings that you have to do a lot of work around. And I think I'm gonna say a few things about some other emotions that I find fascinating. The feeling of being hurt is the most avoided emotion in the marketplace. And I have a personal, I always say there's certain emotions, and they're all different, that all of us have, we have an avoidance towards. I'm always curious about the emotions I don't want to feel, because there's normally a story attached to that. And so I'm always like, which emotion don't you want to check in with? And then what's the story behind that? And again, I don't say why, I say what's the story, because why is like I feel like they're on the stand now in a trial. But the feeling of hurt, when last did you see an executive get up in front of his team and say, I'm really hurt? And yet we feel hurt all the time. Like, but hurt is, it would insinuate weakness. And when you're in a corporate environment, you definitely don't want to show them you're bleeding. So then you don't show them you're bleeding, which makes everyone think no one's hurt, even though they are hurt. So then if you are hurt, you have to go somewhere else to be taken care of. And what happens when your kid's hurt? They just need you to like get down on the ground, look them in the eye and say, I see you. Let me put this Band-Aid over you. You know, I'm not taking you to the hospital. This is really nothing, but you don't tell them all that, because you don't want to shame them. You just say, hey, I'm so sorry you hurt. You put a Band-Aid on and they start running around again. But now take that into the adult world. Oh, I'm never hurt. And I remember it was a few months ago, or maybe a year or two ago, my wife looked at me and she said, what are you feeling with me? And I said, just this and that and that. And she goes, you're hurt by me. And now don't ever tell anyone what their emotions are, unless it's your spouse. You could probably have a few more liberty. Try not to tell people what they're feeling. Just keep inviting them. But she said, you're hurt by me. I said, oh, no, I'm not hurt. Oh, no, you didn't do anything. She goes, well, I want you to know I have hurt you. Like what I did there is hurtful. And eventually I could see it and I go, I guess you're right. And my wife's not this aggressive, but this is what it feels like and how I characterize her. She was going, well, say it. And then I was, because again, emotions need to be expressed. So then I was able to say, you've really hurt me. And that was I could barely get the words out of my mouth because I don't admit that I'm hurt. And then she was able to say, gosh, I'm so sorry I hurt you. So she finished the loop, but she needed me to first show up to the hurt before she could show up and close the loop. So hurt is a tough one.
We want to hear from you. Send us your leadership questions on Instagram @evolvingleader, and John and Scott will address them in a future show. And be sure you're subscribed to the Evolving Leader podcast on your favorite platforms so you catch all of our exciting new content. Thank you for listening. Now, let's get back to the show.
You mentioned, you know, showing weakness is obviously very countercultural in virtually every business setting. But what happens, you know, when and you see people being hurt all the time, and then because they don't have a mechanism or a practice of acknowledging it, at least to themselves. Yes. What ends up happening, I think, is you see this suppressed hurt manifesting itself as acting out from what other people then perceive as a bruised ego.
Well, and do you know what repressed hurt becomes?
Mm.
If you're hurt and you don't want to admit you're hurt, the shadowed side of that feeling shows up, which is resentment.
Yeah.
So when you're resentful, chances are you're likely hurt. Very few other emotions create resentment. It's normally I was hurt. Hurt has not been acknowledged. So, you know, basically, I think what my wife was saying is like, you need to stop being so resentful. And she realized the only way that I could be less resentful was to show up to my hurt so I could get healing for my hurt.
Yeah.
No, yeah. You're spot on. You nailed it.
If you watch typical boardroom or a management meeting and, you know, you see people scoring points over one another, a lot of that is actually just resentment.
Yes.
Being resolved.
Yes. 100%. And so I'm learning to confess hurt. I'm in recovery for hurt, the feeling of hurt. And I'm telling you, every one of my 12 emotions they're like a project for me. How do I show up to this feeling in a way that can be more constructive and healthy? Oh, wow, look, I didn't. All right, let's have some curiosity and grace around that. Show back up to the game. Good news, I have feelings this afternoon, feelings tomorrow, the next day. Like, there's always another round. You know, and so off we go. I'll say lonely is pretty big. People are more lonely than they've ever been. Go read the statistics. It's worse than smoking. Loneliness epidemic is going to take the life. I think in the next few decades, we'll see from COVID especially, but even before that, we have a loneliness issue. People are medicated here in the United States at rates that are unprecedented. Why? Because we're a country of the independence. Like we're all about independence, right? And I'm an American citizen, so I speak this side of the line, but my accent may get me into trouble. But the point is, we're fighting for independence, which means, well, what about interdependence? And I think that's what we really needed. So now we're lonely. I can't work out why I'm so lonely. Well, I have a great back deck, but my front porch is very minimal. We don't hang out on the front porch. We hang out on the back deck, so no one can find us. Go to Europe. A lot of the times there's cities and places where everyone's out front.
Yeah.
So there's more connection. So loneliness is a big one. And the last feeling, I think we talked about it briefly, but being cared for, that's also a very vulnerable feeling, especially in the marketplace, because it's like, well, what's your motive? I don't trust being cared for. Do you really care about me? Are you joking or are you manipulating me? Is this like a, you gave me the day off, but is it because you are about to ask me for something else? Like,
yeah,
like being cared for is a tough emotion. And when you feel cared for and it's the pure feeling of it, oh my gosh, it just feels so good, but also a hard one to accept.
Can we talk about one emotion which is kind of repressed, I think, a lot in organizations, is anger.
Yes.
Because it's not regarded as being, again, it's another form of weakness, you know, it's a loss of control. And it's also regarded as being, violent, really, in most organizations. So it's suppressed. And then we have a kind of like a false kind of positivity sometimes when people are not feeling those things. But then it comes out, has to come out somewhere. It comes out in relationships outside of work often. Can we talk a little bit about anger and your experiences of working with that?
Yeah. I think anger is a fantastic emotion. I think if you don't have anger, we wouldn't even be on this conversation today. Anger is, you have to be angry for something to want to have a voice to advocate. Anger drives advocacy. People don't go marching in the streets because they're apathetic. They go marching in the streets because they want to say something about something that they care about, something that's important to them, something they have an anger for. Now, I'm talking about just the idea of just anger in of itself as emotion. Now, anger can be directed towards a shadowed expression, or it could have this golden expression. But anger in itself, how do you feel about human trafficking? Are you angry about human trafficking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you angry about the rate of divorce? Are you angry about the rate of businesses closing down? Are you angry about the rate of drugs? Are you you better be angry. And so even when you show up to work, if you don't have an anger for work, you just won't show up. And so tied to anger, when people become apathetic, It's that they've actually lost the gift of the emotion of anger. It's just it's a whatever. And my favorite word is whatever. And my wife knows I'm either hurt or I'm angry and I've given up my anger. And now I'm just like, well, you know, whatever. And then she'll say, wow, what did you want that you're giving up? What were you angry about? Like the healthy form of what was firing through your bones that you wanted to express or advocate for that you just threw your hands up in the air and said, whatever. And there's always something. I can always find it. So the problem is, though, if the anger, the way we express this, John, is that when we see an angry person, we have to differentiate between are they afraid or angry. So that's an important differentiator.
Yeah.
Because sometimes if you're raging, you're actually afraid. You're not angry.
Right.
So your rage is like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to shut this thing down because I'm so afraid of the outcome instead of I really want this to happen, which is anger.
Yeah.
I'll offer one last thought on the feeling of anger, which is this, and because I'm going to bring it back to the news and the media, and I don't spend a lot of time in there, but I'll say there's a lot of people who are angry, but you can't be demanding. You can't attach demand to anger. The purity of anger is advocacy, not demanding that someone else be angry about the same thing you care about. So if you care about human trafficking, but you look down at me because I don't care about it as much as you, there's something else I care about more than you. Like, and so I could judge you in the same light and say, well, I really care about digging wells in Africa because that's where I'm from. Why don't you care about digging wells in Africa? Well, you better care about it. And you're looking at me, well, you better care about what I care about. And now you're in a demanding dance with anger. And we're saying, well, what I'm angry about, everyone has to be angry about. And the reality is you have to be able to say, I see your anger. I validate it. I don't share the same anger, but I respect and validate the things you are angry about or passionate about or want to advocate for. And that's where we get into challenges, is the demand, attaching the feeling of, not demand, it's the demand to the anger.
Hmm. I want to come back to your stories that led you on this path that you're currently on. As you know, you described them as forced change, but as I listen to them, I hear a lot of intentional response from you. You know, these
yes.
events happened and you consciously chose to, you know, look inside yourself, to walk a new path, to get really centered in your life. And I, you know, the work that you're doing is allowing and encouraging others to do the same. And on a podcast, it's hard to take people on that kind of journey because they haven't had a chance to like do the work themselves necessarily as they're listening to this. But I'm just wondering if there's thinking through the lens of intentionality of, you know, recovering the heart and soul of leadership. What's something specific you could encourage our listeners with right now?
That's a great question. So we have been up in the mind. Mm-hmm. We've been learning. If you're sitting in your car or on the train or you're at home, your brain is filling up with new knowledge, new information. And chances are you're probably having feelings about me. You may not like me. You may love me. You may want more. You may not appreciate something else in your life. You may be going home to a family member, to a relationship. You may have just left work. You have all sorts of feelings right now. So what I'd offer you is, as the next step is, to try to access what you're feeling. Now, the core feeling framework that I use, there's several else out there. They're a dime a dozen. But they are words on a page to help you identify what you're feeling so you can say them out loud. Now you're into the area of practice. So I'm going to tell you to go to right now, practice and express what you're feeling and say it out loud, either to yourself, maybe find someone, again, if you're on the train, let's ask the guy next to you if you can tell him what you're feeling. And and the goal is this: do not explain why you feel that. Well, you know, I feel really sad. Well, because, you know, my neighbor did this and this. Don't go into your story. Just identify every single emotion that feels real for you right now and say it out loud. very systematically, but not so your brain can know it, but so that your heart can speak it. Okay. So that's a very practical thing. So I probably check in at least once a day. And then I run some of these emotional intelligence groups. So some days I'm checking in three times. And the things I checked in on the morning, the feelings I had in the morning, some of them are lingering. And some of them have changed. By the time afternoon rolls around, something else is at the forefront of my insides. And I bring it to the world and I go, hey, I'm actually feeling hurt, sad, and excited. And then the gift that you can get is to have someone else hear you. If they ask you to explain, just say, is it okay if I don't? Because now you have to justify why you have your feelings, which takes most of us back to our childhood, where you have to justify being human. Hmm. Well, I'm sad. Well, why are you sad? Well, I'm hurt. Well, get over it. Well, I'm feeling scared. Well, don't be. Hmm. So these roll off our tongues. Trust me, I'm a parent of four. It's like, oh, your ice cream's on the ground. Oh, gosh, like you're late for school. Well, you'll figure it out. Like, get over it. Rather than just staying with my kid in the emotion, knowing that the emotion won't dictate their whole life. So we have to learn how to be with people in their emotions and just say, thank you. Thanks for sharing. So find the words, say them out loud. And then to get into your soul, again, I'm going to outsource you for that, as you heard. But if anything, I would read books around the concepts of deepening your why, but don't learn the book. Don't study the book. Oh, I read Simon's book. Really? Well, what did it do for you? Well, what do you mean? Well, no, he has that whole thing about the why and the this and the that. And then so-and-so has this book about this. Okay. Well, you didn't do any, like you haven't experienced it. The message. Mm-hmm. The message is, what is my deepest sense of purpose and meaning on earth? So I think those are two different spaces. I'm not saying they can't be together, but I think you have to isolate them. It's like, the heart is like legs day at the gym. I'm back to the gym analogy because I'm not going. So it's like legs day because they're a big muscle group. But then it's like the core, or when you do core work, I feel like that's your soul. It's like the core of who we are, the substance of who we are. So there's ways. There are plenty of ways. I'd love to take you on a journey, and I'd love to do an exercise right now, and we could check in around that. And we probably will. But there are so many ways to start experiencing your heart and your soul. Maybe we should stop learning about it as much and start to actually experience it.
I know we're over time, so I want to be mindful of that. There's so many more questions we didn't even get to, but this has been so, so helpful. Thank you, Rob.
Oh, you're welcome.
Rob, this has been a wonderful hour and a bit with you. And I think you've given us lots of very, very practical things, but you've also... leaven this with a sense of authenticity and vulnerability in sharing a lot of things here that bring this to life in a way that it's very hard to otherwise. So I, on behalf of Scott and I, I'm really, really grateful for your time. Thank you.
Well, folks, until next time, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?